The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm your host, John Still, Head of Content at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined today by ExchangeWire founder and CEO, Rachel Smith. Rachel, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, John. I feel like it's my podcast again.
You're back. Very regular appearances these days.
Which I'm very happy about.
Well, by public demand. So our special guest today is James Rosewell from Movement for an Open Web. James, really pleased to have you on. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the invite. It's great to be back in the land of podcasts.
Well, no, you're very welcome. And when I was at the start of the week, when we were looking at the stories for this, I was really hoping that something would come up that was up your street for Movement for an Open Web. And of course, Google have provided. But before we kick off, James, just tell us a little bit about your what you're doing at Movement for an Open Web and your work there.
Yeah, so the whole sort of journey started in January 2020, which is when Google's privacy sandbox moved from being a kind of private conversation in the backwaters of standards bodies to something that was announced. And I run, when I'm not doing Movement for an Open Web, I run a B2B data business called 51 Degrees. And this started to have some impacts on us. We were what would be called unintended consequences. I'm not involved in the advertising or publishing business at all, but I was quite concerned about this. So that led me to talk to other people. I'm an engineer, entrepreneur, not a lawyer, not an economist, not a product manager in advertising. But I started speaking to those people, got involved with the CMA. They were running their market study into the digital market. They were halfway through at this point. They published the report in July 2020, still is the most comprehensive analysis of this industry produced by anyone. Spoke to, say, people in other disciplines, spoke to the CMA, and ultimately said, well, what gets done? How do we solve this problem? How do we keep the web open for business? You know, it needs to have a viable advertising ecosystem in order to be healthy and viable in the future. And they said, well, we need someone to complain. So I, together with Tim Cohen, a lawyer, founded Movement for an Open Web to be the original complainant that got the CMA involved. So whatever you think of the current situation, it's somewhat my fault.
Well, excellent. Thank you for that. And well, who better to discuss our first story in that case? The CMA have released their most recent report this week into the privacy sandbox. The report was delayed from July and covers Q2 and Q3 this year. The CMA seems largely satisfied with Google's adherence to fair competition, but retains concerns regarding user choice mechanisms in Chrome and has urged Google to update its commitments accordingly. You've released a press, you had a statement this week, James, that came from Movement for an Open Web regarding it. Talk us through it and what this, another warning, means for Google.
Well, the report is authored by the two organisations, the CMA and the ICO. So when you read the report, it can be a bit painful because it kind of separates out the two organisations. So the CMA say, well, we've been advised by the ICO. And of course, the CMA can't talk about privacy and data protection because that's not in their charter. They're a competition authority, so they need to rely on the ICO. And reading the report, it almost feels like the case team within the CMA have been completely replaced and the new team haven't sort of read the material going back over 4 years that kind of, you know, led to all of this. So there's plenty of instances when you kind of read the report and you can see prior issues or evidence that's been raised, not just by Movement for an Open Web, but by others, particularly the testing reports, that is just ignored. So I think there's a real question about the thoroughness of the report. If you take previous reports, it was all about testing. Yet this report has nothing really about testing. You know, the CMA seemed to have been sort of, you know, magically satisfied. So I think there's a concerning direction in particularly the CMA's position that we need to get to the bottom of. So I would encourage listeners, particularly if you're already involved with the CMA, to look at the report from that angle and ask the CMA how they've reached some of their conclusions in Appendix 2. because it seems to contravene the evidence that's been provided. And of course, we're looking at that as well. Then you've got the ICO's opinion. And I think, you know, this is very insightful. So in the CMA, the ICO's report on dark patterns, they talk about consent sludge. And it seems, you know, a theme of all the different APIs is the consent mechanism. So you're asking users to consent to Topics API, to consent to PAPI, to consent to shared storage. You know, they're just going, well, this just doesn't work. And then their other concerns are around the way that the APIs could be used. I realize we've got quite a broad group of listeners, but a term that might have got out into the market is k-anonymity. So this is effectively the number of events that need to be included in an aggregation. So Google, in order to satisfy some of the competition concerns, have allowed the users to have more control. When I say user, the website owner, effectively, to have more control over that granularity. So you could say, you know, what works for Volkswagen at a country level might not work for a local chain of hairdressers, for example, as an advertiser. The volumes are going to be different, therefore that number could be adjusted. So the ICO will say things like, we're concerned that this could be abused. Yeah. Which for me is the same as, well, any technology can be abused. You know, what's actually wrong with third-party cookies and the ability to interoperate between different organizations? There's not really a material problem with that. If the technology is used unlawfully, to pick an analogy, if you speed in a car, you know, it's not the manufacturer of the car's fault. It's the driver. And whilst there's free will in the world, there'll be people who speed. And I really don't think we're trying to eliminate free will. So the ICO take a very convoluted route to basically say, user beware. And then moving on to the sort of third theme of the report, we then look at remedies that might be possible. And one of them is that Google are going to produce a report for the ICO and the CMA, or they're proposing they produce a report for the ICO and the CMA each year, that's basically explaining how privacy violations might be taking place on Google products by people who aren't Google, or by entities that are not Google. If the ICO and the CMA are going to accept that, it's like saying, yes, we're fine to bless you, Google, as the vigilante that's going to police privacy across the digital ecosystem. I think that's extremely dangerous. It will drive, you know, incentives and behaviors. And who is it for Google to say that, you know, that local chain of hairdressers who are advertising with local publishers are, you know, in some way violating privacy rules? And certainly if it's not applied to Google themselves within Google's own systems, then that creates a two-tier environment. So that in itself is a competition problem. So in it's paragraph 14, there are four different remedies that are kind of being summarized. One of them is that report that Google would produce. So rather than creating the hard restrictions, they would kind of grass offenders up to the ICO, basically, which I say is problematic. But other things in there are a governance framework. So effectively, Privacy Sandbox would be subject to some new governance model. It's unclear to me how that would function in a way that was in any way neutral. If it were like the W3C, which is absolutely not neutral, despite what it says on the tin. We can talk more about that in a minute if you like. Then we've got a real problem, because every participant in the industry will feel compelled to attend if they have to use Privacy Sandbox. There's clearly going to be a diversity of opinions. It's not clear how those are going to be settled in any sort of reasonable way. So we just have this continued distraction tax on the industry. So ultimately, I'll pause at this point, the only real remedy is just to guarantee interoperability so Privacy Sandbox can compete on its merits. So if businesses want to continue to use third-party cookies, they can. If they want to use Privacy Sandbox because it's so much better, then they can. If they want to use some other competing solution, then they can. If they want to use all three, then they can. So movement for an open web is all about competition on the merits. And we've you know, we're delighted to see privacy sandbox as a solution and all the other types of solutions, you know, identifiers and other types of pets, privacy enhancing technologies. But they should compete on the merit so that the market decides, not the monopolist.
Yeah, I've been, you know, reading your statement you made earlier about this, and you described the governance framework as Google marking its own homework, which is very neat and very true, I'd say. Rachel, how do you feel about this the CMA report this week?
I feel as though this particular report doesn't necessarily provide us with a scenario that's terribly different from the one that we've been dealing with for the past, you know, certainly for the entirety of 2024. James just went into a bit of detail there about why the report perhaps reads the way that it does, but it very much to me feels as though it is a juxtaposition between the privacy concerns and the anti-competition concerns. And maybe that's somewhat explained by the fact that it's jointly produced by the CMA and the ICO, with the CMA caring more about competition and market independence and health, and the ICO perhaps caring more about data privacy. I don't know. But the point is, it feels as though it's a report that's trying to deal with those concerns in the round, and I'm not sure that the mechanisms that are currently in place fill me with a sense of confidence that we're heading in a useful direction. I'm not saying it's entirely useless, but it, you know, we've got a long list of some of the concerns that have been raised by the ICO and the CMA, and we've got a list of actions that have been taken to mitigate some of those concerns. So you can see that there's some progress that's been achieved since the last report, but I don't think there is enough, you know, sort of assurances that what has been done in the meantime, and this is all activity that's been undertaken by Google, presumably taking into account people's feedback and working group stakeholder input, making amends to their privacy sandbox suite of tools, and, you know, getting into the detail of what each of those APIs do and trying to address various concerns. I think that's one thing. I'm not sure that necessarily puts the industry in a significantly different position than where we were at the start of the year. So if we were thinking about what we want to, you know, what we hope to achieve as an industry as a result of some of this government intervention and, you know, this sort of slightly legislative framework that some of this activity hinges itself to, in addition to James's desire to have an open, marketplace, I think what the industry wants to see is suitable protection for various corners of businesses within the industry that enable them to appropriately compete, right? Publishers will be deeply concerned about the future of their businesses, but so will ad tech companies and ad tech providers, and marketers will be concerned about what they can and can't do. So this is a lengthy report that focuses on the detail of some of the work that's been done within Privacy Sandbox to address previous concerns. There's clearly been some progress, but there's a lot more to be done. And I guess we wait to see what putting deprecation for third-party cookies in the hands of the consumer will really mean, because I think it's likely that lots of consumers will opt out, some won't, and the mechanisms that drive us to that point is what really is going to have an impact on the industry. And I think that's what James is mostly concerned with, a movement for an open web, and certainly that's probably some of the activity that you're trying to influence at the CMA and the ICO level. And all I see through this report is a bit of a status update. Again, not surprising to hear James's characterization that it feels like just a whole bunch of new staff have walked in and rewritten the report and started from scratch again. It gives you a nice little, you know, well-designed little box of concerns and progress, status updates, but I don't think we're actually really getting anywhere meaningful for now.
Yeah, Rachel, you mentioned about third-party cookies. So the ICO in their sections often cite research that was done by Google. Now, it's a shame that research isn't published in its entirety, or if it is, there isn't a link I could easily find to it. Maybe it is in the footnotes. But it talks about people's awareness of third-party cookies and says they're not aware of third-party cookies. Why would you be aware of third-party cookies? Just like you probably don't know when you drive a car about carburetors. It's not a requirement to drive a car to know about a carburetor. So that seems perfectly reasonable, hardly a surprise. And then the ICO are concerned about, you know, self-preferencing dark patterns. You know, the got it button when you confirm is in blue, whereas the settings button is in grey. You know, that is a dark pattern. I think most people in our field will be aware of that now. There's been a great education program on that, and that, you know, that should be avoided. So these nudging and steering is a, you know, is a key part of it. But what I really think we're getting to is there's got to surely now be a point where we just say time out. You know, this whole sandbox thing is a busted flush. It needs to be put to one side, guaranteed interoperability for the competition folks. Yeah. So you don't have to second guess. You don't have to, you know, be thinking about this through 2025 as we've been thinking about it through 24, 23, 22, 21. We've actually got guaranteed interoperability. Google can then proceed with Privacy Sandbox and it can compete on its merits. For those businesses that want to use it, they can use it.
I mean, to be honest with you, I think if you had a conversation with the folks that are deeply embedded with working at Privacy Sandbox, I think a lot of them may very well agree, right? You know, they are trying to run that organization as a separate division from Google. Some, you know, I've spoken to some people that are working in Privacy Sandbox, and that is the direction that they want to take. They want to be a fully fledged, you know, credible technology solution that can compete with other technology solutions. The rub probably comes in here where when we know that, you know, all throughout the report, there's constant referencing to whatever it is that Google decides to do with Privacy Sandbox has to satisfy the requirement to not be preferencing its own ad tech stack and its own ad tech solutions. And that's where we then start to dive back into the sort of, you know, swampy detail of what can and can't be tolerated by legislators and what is and isn't interpreted as competitive behaviour. And don't forget that there's all sorts of other activity going on, you know, outside of the legislative controls of the UK or even elsewhere in Europe. That's probably impacting some of this too from a Google standpoint within their own organization. But, you know, ultimately, I certainly think that most professionals in the industry will be wanting to move to a position where they are designing tools and solutions if they're a technology company, or understanding what tools and solutions to work with if they're a buyer, an agency, a brand, and understanding what is the best way to shore up the sustainable future of their business if they're a publisher. And they'll be wanting to base all of those decisions on what is accessible and realistic today and what looks like will be accessible and realistic in another 12 months' time. And I don't think anyone would disagree with the fact that chat about deprecation of third-party cookies has totally distracted everybody over the last couple of years. It's a useful point in time for us to move on from that altogether. That doesn't stop, though, this sort of legislative, regulatory chat going on in the background. And of course, you know, James, that I sort of present that as though it's just sort of irritating clutter. I know that's the sort of stuff that you are deeply embedded in. So, you know, maybe you've got a slightly more optimistic outlook in terms of how much you feel that you and others in the industry can influence that. But regardless of what happens there, I think people have got to build their businesses in ways that they feel confident about today.
Yeah.
And forget about what's happening over at Privacy Sandbox to a certain extent where you can.
I completely agree. And the very best way to do that is to guarantee interoperability through third-party cookies, through local storage, through IP addresses, through user agents, through URLs, just like we guarantee connectivity on the telephones. You know, we're not having to change our mobile phones because a new telecom standard comes out every year and the old one immediately gets deprecated. Yeah, we don't have to do that. So we just need to guarantee that interoperability, and then we can achieve the outcome that you just described. I completely reject the premise that it's for Google to degrade that interoperability. That's always been the my position and the position of Movement for an Open Web. It's the equivalent of the telecoms company coming in and suddenly saying, "Oh, we don't like certain words in text messages. We're going to delete them." Yeah, it's just not their role to do that. We have laws, you know, predating the independence of America in relation to common carriage that apply here. We have telecoms regulation around, you know, what British Telecom and Vodafone and all these companies can and can't do. So it's not surprising in history that an industry, when it reaches maturity, has these kind of issues. So I don't think the fact that we're having this dialogue is particularly unusual in history, but we do now need to bring it to an end. And what the report tells us is the easiest way to deal with this, the most effective way to deal with this from both a privacy and a competition perspective, is simply enable the data controller to comply with the law in whichever way they see fit. So therefore, a publisher that wants to use privacy as a non-price factor of competition and talk about their, you know, privacy is free to do so. They can use PETS and Privacy Sandbox if they wish. But another publisher that perhaps feels that their users are less concerned about privacy and more concerned about offers or access to information without friction, they're free to you know, take a position on privacy that, you know, suits their business requirements, their brand and their requirements. And all of this would fall away. So I would love to do what you just described, Rachel, for 2025, but it needs to be through guaranteeing interoperability.
And that's where the real work is.
I'm going to move us on now to our next story. And James, you've described Apple as Google's partners in crime. And hey, presto, Apple are also under the microscope today, as if by magic. This week, Apple are expected to become the first company fined by EU antitrust regulators under the new big tech rules. Regulators charged Apple in June, alleging violations of the Digital Markets Act, marking the Commission's first enforcement action under this new ruling. So from the CMA to the DMA, James, are you pleased to see the DMA showing some bite here?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've also got the, you know, the musical chairs at the European Commission. We've also got the musical chairs. So we've got a new group of commissioners coming in. I think we're in November, December is the sort of cusp. So there'll be a new set of commissioners responsible for enforcing. But the prior commissioners seem to be using the Digital Markets Act. I think it was a very ballsy move of Apple to effectively stick the middle finger up at the commission when it came to the implementation of the DMA. And we'll see how that goes for them. They're effectively gambling that their customers are so loyal to Apple and so conditioned by Apple's messaging that they will, you know, reject the position of their elected representatives. Apple might have misunderstood how Europe works.
Interesting, yeah. Rachel, how do you think are you happy to see the DMA trying to take a chunk out of Apple?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the first fine under the Digital Markets Act, so I think it's really good to see to see legislators in the EU taking action and using this piece of legislation. I think it's always really interesting when we get to this point in the journey of legislative controls. Remember the days of GDPR and all the chit chat and talk about what the world would be like once that legislation arrived, and then when it got really interesting was the ensuing sort of, you know, 4, 5, 6 years where we started to see how it was actually going to be applied. So I think it's a really important moment in history for this piece of legislation, because you need to see it being actually used to understand what's going to happen next. I concur with James. I think it was really, one could argue perhaps, James didn't say this, but I will. One could argue perhaps it was typical of Apple to think that they could just kind of do what they wanted and the consequences wouldn't really be that much of a big deal for them. But I don't know, you know, like 10% of global turnover, if I was the chief accountant at Apple, I wouldn't be okay with that. Obviously, that's the maximum amount they could be fined. Again, it'll be really interesting to see how this legislation is used and applied when it comes to actually disclosing how much Apple will be deciding and then disclosing how much Apple will be fined. You'd imagine that there's got to be some kind of, you know, scale of severity in terms of the infringement, so they might not be getting the full 10%. But still, you know, it's not insignificant, is my point. And I know we've had, John, you know, over the years, many conversations on several different podcasts about fining big tech companies and whether those fines actually really make any difference to them, and because they don't often tend to really hit the purse in any great, you know, sort of confident way. So that's what will be interesting to hear, to see how much of a fine is brought forward and whether legislators in the EU feel that that is actually going to have an impact on Apple, to see whether it does, or rather to see whether they actually just look at the requirements that the DMA have said they need to show them in order to satisfy their concerns. And actually, those are the requirements that Apple have been asked, you know, they've been asked to make these changes several years ago, and they've also come up in the what's the name of the gaming provider? Epic. They've also come up in the Epic Games court case. So one could look at this and just think, why don't you, and like I said, especially if I was the chief accountant at Apple, I might just say, can we not just maybe make some changes here, guys? Like, I'm a bit sick of being given a bill. Let's just try and do a few things differently and see what happens. But again, you know, if they decide not to go down that path, it says probably more about where Apple sees its business model over the coming kind of 5 to 10 years than their feelings about privacy. You know, I have a suspicion that the reason Apple don't want to cede these changes in the way that they operate is because they make so much revenue out of them. So, you know, and they're not making as much revenue out of hardware as they used to before. So perhaps this also reflects a shift in their business model.
There's three things I'd like to sort of say. So firstly, to tie it back to the CMA, you were just saying, Rachel, interoperability needs to be guaranteed. That's part of the DMA. They can't degrade interoperability. So if you're a core platform service, of which Safari and iOS are, then you can't degrade interoperability for others. So the DMA are only just getting started on that. So just imagine the economic benefit for the UK if we suddenly had cookies back on Apple by default from next year. Yeah, publishers would not have this issue of Android versus Safari, the two-tier. Revenues would start to return. Those publishers in the UK would be paying taxes in the UK. You know, this would have a material benefit to the industry, and the DMA requires that. But let's just look at the UK, is my second point. So we have the digital markets unit. So in Washup, just before the general election, the DMCC, the Digital Market Consumer and Competition Bill, went through Parliament. It was kind of rushed through in the last week. So the DMU, the Digital Markets Unit, which is the CMA with superpowers, is now coming into effect. Now, the first thing to do is designate strategic market status companies, and that will finish no later than March of next year. And we would expect Google and Apple to be on there. It would be very bizarre for the European Commission to designate them and for the UK not to. So the UK then has these new powers that come in as well. So we'll start to have a role in this as well, which I think is also good. And finally, when you look at how Apple have abused privacy to generate money, we now have findings of fact in this search case in the US. So Apple benefit to the tune of $20 billion a year from an illegal monopoly in search advertising run by Google. So Apple are making $20 billion. It's a 36% revenue share. So rough maths, $40 billion to Google, $20 billion to Apple. And both companies have an incentive to degrade other solutions to reach audiences because it drives up revenue on their platform. Yeah. So for Apple to take a position around privacy as a defense to some of these practices is just shameful. we know that. However, they do a very good job from their perspective of misleading their customers. So I think what we can do as an industry is use our powers in advertising to make it clearer to people using Apple products exactly how Apple are abusing them.
I mean, I'm pretty sure Kieran's used some very colourful language to describe exactly that scenario, James, in years gone by on our podcast and in various panel discussions. You know, I think he calls it, to use slightly more polite language, I think he calls it, you know, one of the greatest shams of all time, this idea that Apple has built their brand around caring about each individual user and protecting their privacy, and in actual fact, a lot of their commercial behaviour is completely contradicting that. So I think that's a really interesting point. I think the point that you also made there about the search bonus, if you like, the search bump that Apple get from their deal with Google. I mean, wasn't that one of the things that came out of the case, the DOJ claim against Google for anti-competition in search, was one of the findings and then recommendations. Well, recommendations, requirements would be you can no longer broker these deals, right? Not only can you dominate as a search engine, you can't give other companies incentives to make your search engine the default, or you get a big chunk of revenue if you do that, etc. So it'd be good to see those sorts of shenanigans come to an end, wouldn't it?
Well, I think there's actually, just on that point, so Google aren't allowed to pay Apple, but who are Apple going to use as an alternative search engine in the short term? It just means Google are going to get another $20 billion and Apple are going to lose $20 billion because they won't be able to put the deal in place. Of course, Google will appeal, so it'll be a number of years before that starts to happen. But I think, you know, I guess our point through this whole conversation is, when I started Movement for Open Web in 2020, people just looked at me blankly and just said, regulators are never going to do anything. Forget it, James, you're whistling in the wind. Forget it. Yeah. Well, regulators are here now. The entire podcast so far, we've been talking about regulators.
100%.
People who didn't know about the CMA beforehand sure do now. Including, you know, you go to New York to an advertising event, the CMA is on everyone's lips. So it's definitely having an effect. And we're just at the very beginning, because as I said earlier, all industries, when they reach maturity, get regulated. And we're just going through that for this industry. So it's a good thing, in my opinion, but everyone has to play a role. Regulation doesn't work in isolation. So I, you know, encourage our listeners to, you know, lean in, either if you're big enough through your own organizations, or through your trade bodies. And if your trade body is unduly dominated by Google, then maybe pick a different trade body.
I mean, and I think those are all points well made, James. Again, you know, the early stages of GDPR, I think a lot of people in this industry were really, you know, head in hands thinking, what are all these politicians and lawmakers doing, getting involved in our business? They don't understand anything about our industry, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's important to pause and reflect on the fact that our industry was very young in those days, advertising technology I'm specifically talking about. You know, here we are another 8 to 10 years down the line, and it now needs to be an accepted part of our professional lives. For those of us that have worked in other industries altogether, we know that's how it goes, right? But for people that have perhaps only ever worked in ad tech or in the digital end of advertising and marketing, this might feel like a new dawn to them. But I think it is absolutely, you know, the way that life is going to be. And it's a good thing to have these legislative controls tested. That was my point at the start of this news article, because that was when GDPR really became, you know, real and also useful. You started to see how what was actually going to have an impact on people's businesses, what was worth preserving and what was worth, you know, lobbying to change and trying to influence in other ways. And I think that's now part of our jobs as professionals in the industry. We, you know, we, like you say, James, the regulation element is sort of here. It's an integrated part of our industry now, and we all need to accept that and get a bit more engaged and a bit more involved, because we're all going to have slightly different opinions about what we would like to see. But that's all the more reason for us to get involved in various organisations, trade bodies and organisations and other forums to influence the outcome.
Yeah, and I think GDPR is a really good example of where we didn't influence the outcome in a positive way. So, as I say, I got involved in this industry in 2020 by accident, as I was explaining at the beginning of the podcast. I look at GDPR and I look at TCF. I mean, TCF is what happens when risk-averse lawyers who don't actually understand people end up designing products. And it's a real problem. I mean, legitimate interest, control over the B2B vendors. GDPR doesn't require any of that. GDPR requires informed consent and establishing a lawful basis. We've just created options for people that cognitively they can't understand. therefore hasn't achieved the intention of the lawmaker. I mean, I referred to carburetors earlier. You don't need to know, you know, how a car works to drive a car. So it really has failed. And I think, you know, as we look to the future and as we look to 2025, we talked about the search case. The DOJ is looking for remedies. They're not imposing remedies. They're looking to consult on remedies. The CMA and the ICO, for all the flaws of the most recent report, have been trying to consult and engage industry. So we need to learn from these lessons, particularly around GDPR, so that we can create something that works more effectively. Because what I want to see is an open web that flourishes, and it's only going to do that if it has a viable advertising economy.
I mean, you're right, James. We don't need to know about the carburetor in order to drive a car, but it is useful for when you take your car to the mechanic. And the only reason I know all of this is because my brother's a mechanic, so I know what a carburetor is. But anyway, I'm just making a comic point about the fact that, you raise a lot of really interesting and good points. And I think the key thing here is that if nothing else, this podcast should be a huge encouragement to everyone in the industry to get even more engaged in some of the topics that we're talking about from a legislative and regulation point of view than they might already be, because it's really important stuff.
Absolutely.
Well, that was a fantastic discussion. We will see whether Apple treat it as a parking ticket to be popped in the drawer and bought around later, or whether they will actually take some discernible change from it. We'll call it there. But thank you so much, James, for joining us. That was really, really interesting. Always fantastic to hear your opinion. And we'll you're welcome back whenever the next ruling comes in.
Well, the next CMA report will be end of January, beginning of February. And then we've got almost certainly announcements from the EC and the US prior to Christmas. So lots still to happen.
Yeah, well, we'll be getting your opinion on those. And thanks again for your time today. Rachel, thank you as always.
My pleasure. I'm expecting some car mechanic queries now that I've confessed that my brother's a mechanic and I know what a carburetor is.
I'm going to have you around to look at the engine of mine. Anyway, thank you both very much. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week on the MadTech Podcast.